complex, but I'd like to define it, in my opinion, and sort of from a broad definition, I'd like to narrow it down. Spirituality is basically a connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
All right.
And it doesn't have to be, one of the things that some people would misunderstand, and maybe I was one of those people at some point, was that people would want to pursue spirituality so that they can get all these, they
some
can do
divine
all
powers,
these, exactly. They
miracles,
can do,
get these miracles.
Yes.
All right.
I wouldn't
That's
use
the
word miracles because miracles are specifically for
or like
prophets.
Vision or something like
yes.
that.
Yes,
those
the
divine
visions,
spiritual
yeah.
powers.
Yeah, they want those spiritual
powers.
Visions.
All right.
Yeah.
So their aim of getting to spirituality itself is wrong.
Oh.
Therefore, that opening never happens because imagine if Allah were to allow someone whose aim is just to get a divine power to enter spirituality, which they will misuse and misguide them. Bigger generation.
True.
It's
so I'm not
selfish,
saying that it is not open because Allah doesn't want it to open. Sometimes our own aims are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The way we progress is wrong. And so I'd like to narrow down the definition to something that is only a connection with Allah. And no one can define that connection with Allah for you apart from yourself.
True.
It's very personal because Allah is someone who you have this personal connection with. He is someone who created you. And that love between you and your creator exists.
Mm-hmm.
How we nurture it is different.
True.
Some might nurture it in a positive way. And then some might get depressed and be like, look, I can't go ahead with this. God doesn't love me. And they get away. But the truth is God loves you more than, God is closer to you than your own jugular vein.
True.
So that spirituality that connection is always there. It's how we nurture it. And that's where spirituality plays a very big role.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you see the Sahifa Sajjadiyah, that's like the, it's like the icing on the cake of all the amals that we have
mm-hmm.
in all the du'as that we have in our, all the supplications that we have from the Ahlul Bayt. And even if you just see the supplication of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, and the whispered supplication of the lovers, and he says, how can one who has tasted your love want the love of another? So that, basically for me, is where spirituality comes. The point I disagree on, though, is that enough teachers don't exist or this is not available for everyone. It is, as I said, that the path we choose and the aims that we have,
mm-hmm.
and some actually might start on this path, but then they feel very discouraged, so they move away. Just a small point on that. Said Qadhi. Agha Qadhi. He is Ayatollah Behjet's teacher.
Mm-hmm.
It took him 40 years to have his first vision. 40
mm-hmm.
years to reach. And he got
mm-hmm.
everything in one day.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he got it at the Haram of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, which is where I want to take my next point. When we want to enter spirituality, the Prophet has said, Qur'an o itrat.
Wow.
You cannot reach spirituality without taking hold of the Ahlul Bayt. Tawassul is one of the
For
most
sure.
important,
tawassul, yeah.
important. Reaching Allah without tawassul, in my opinion, the opinion of the Sufis, is basically, you're not going to get much.
Actually, some people like today think that they consider Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as some of their cousins, like God will understand, God will know, trying to say that we have some very good connection with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as she said, rightly mentioned, that without Ahlul Bayt, we cannot reach that goal. Well, you are listening to Back to Reality. Here we need to take a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back. You're listening to Back to Reality from IRIB English Radio. I have with me two special guests. I have with me Fatima from California, and I have with me Siddiqa from the UK. And we are discussing about the spirituality. And both of you guys introduced the topic in a very nice way. I don't think I need to add something on it. However, Fatima, you said that you use a term, you said spirituality in Islam, and you said it's also outside Islam. So I would want you to differentiate between the two. How do you define Islamic spirituality and non-Islamic spirituality?
I think the Christian mystics, the Jewish people have their Kabbalah, mysticism. Non-Ahl Kitab, other religions, I don't know as much about. They all have their own holy book and spirituality, things they were doing. So, and then especially in the U.S., I don't know about other countries as much, but U.S., Canada, there's so many people who are now saying there's no need for any religion. They're just like secular, and they just say that we believe in one God, Muwahid, monotheistic, but there's no need for any religion. We just have our direct spirituality with God. We don't need any other organized religion. Those people, they make up their own spirituality. So I don't know. It just depends on which background they're in. But I think, obviously, I believe I've been shown in my life, and my mom converted to Islam when I was a kid. So I was raised in it. I didn't really choose it. She already chose it for me. But throughout my life, there was so many challenges, so many things I could really see that there's really, and I didn't study that much other paths, but I've read a little bit here and there. I think there's really there's different paths to Allah, but I think it's obvious the only real straight path, best spiritual path to Allah is through the Ahl al-Bayt al-Islam, because they're Muslims. I've hung out with them. I've seen their different things. You know, they do claim to love the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Each of them have their own little, you know, connection to him, but they can't get that much too deep into the spirituality because they don't know about Ahl al-Bayt. You know, they respect, okay, Imam Ali.
True.
You know, some of the countries, I think some of the African countries and some places, maybe in the Ashura, I think in Turkey, they have maybe like some one little special prayer, you know, but they're not understanding that much what it is. So I feel like definitely the Shia, Ithna Ashari, 12-er path of spirituality, that, as she said, I forgot to say that, the tawassul to the Ahl al-Bayt al-Islam, there's nothing else like that. That's the beginning and the self-purification. And they have to help us, because without them, we don't have any spirituality, you know. And Imam Zaman alayhi salam, I think our connection to Imam Zaman as well as Allah, you know, there's no other way we can understand anything from the spirituality. And I mean, I think there is, I didn't mean to say like there's absolutely not enough of these teachers. There's definitely enough of these teachers, but maybe we're not, you know, it depends on the person. We only meet certain ones, you know, certain people can only qualified to be with them, you know. That was what I meant.
We pray that you attain that spirituality, you attain the Islamic spirituality, we attain that too.
Inshallah.
With that hope, we close today's session. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much for listening. You are listening to IRIP English Radio.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A year ago, Israeli regime forces bombed hundreds of buildings in the Gaza Strip during the 11-day war, also known as the Sword of Al-Quds Battle. The wanton Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. The Gaza-based resistance groups Mili Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Resistance Committees also fired some 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin al-Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Overwhelmed by the significantly developed military capabilities of Palestinian resistance factions, the Israeli regime was forced to announce a unilateral ceasefire.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinian resistance factions fired thousands of rockets against the Zionist regime.
forcing it to desperately call for a ceasefire after 11 days. The resistance is prepared to respond to any aggression, and nowadays the military capabilities of the resistance are better than last year. The Zionist enemy must understand that attacking Al-Quds will result in a new war.
The 11-day war saw the heaviest fighting between Gaza resistance factions and Israeli regime forces since 2014. Over the past decade, Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza have been boosting their production capacity for homemade rockets and drones. During the May war, Israel's Iron Dome also proved to be a failure. The multi-million-dollar high-tech missile system was unable to protect the Israeli regime.
During the 11-day war last year, 2021, Hamas and the Palestinians scored very well against Israel in a number of things. One is the launching of rockets against Israel closed very much Israeli airports, port, and the Israeli business community. In addition to that, the Palestinians succeeded in unifying all fronts.
The Israeli regime has waged four wars on the Gaza Strip since 2007 under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts believe in any future war, the Israeli regime will be dealt a heavy blow by Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Representatives from 55 countries and 22 international organizations gathered in Brussels on Tuesday to raise money for Syrians impacted by more than a decade of conflict.
The total pledge amounts to 6.4 billion euros.
Aid agencies say that amount pales into insignificance when compared to the colossal amount of money the West continues to pump into the Ukrainian army, not to mention the cost of taking in a huge number of Ukrainian refugees. Rights groups point out that 7 million Syrian refugees fled to neighbouring countries while the EU closed its borders to them during the past 11 years. Recently, within weeks, the EU welcomed 5 million Ukrainian refugees. For the first time, Russia was not invited to the annual fundraising conference for Syria in Brussels. Moscow was even singled out for blame.
The Russian war will increase food and energy prices, and the situation in Syria will become worse.
Critics say it was in fact the US and its EU allies that tore Syria apart and then turned their backs on the Syrian people. The West tried in vain for years to oust Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Russia should have been invited to the Brussels conference, it suggested. Analysts say Vladimir Putin's address delivered last Monday was moderate in tone.
So maybe this is the momentum which needs to be seized by the Americans, by the European Union, and say, okay, we have to figure this out. Let's see that we can talk.
Delegates heard how 90% of people in Syria are living in poverty. Groups like Oxfam and Save the Children say all the financial pledges made must be kept. That has not happened in previous years. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Opposition leader Keir Starmer has been at the front of the chorus urging Prime Minister Boris Johnson to do the decent thing and step down after being fined for his part in a series of lockdown gatherings dubbed Partygate. Now the Labour leader has become embroiled in a controversy of his own, nicknamed Currygate, after being pictured enjoying a meal and a drink in what the party's calling a work event, but one being dubbed an illegal gathering by his opponents.
First and foremost, no rules were broken. I don't actually believe that those that are accusing me believe rules were broken. They are trying to simply drag all politicians into a place where the public think we're all the same. For me, this is an in-principle position. No rules were broken. I'm absolutely clear about that. But in the event that I'm wrong about that and I get a fixed penalty notice, I will do the right thing and step down.
Political observers think this is a risky strategy.
Well, I think that his advisers think this is a really good ploy to contrast him with Boris Johnson, who, of course, didn't resign, having been fined for breaking the lockdown regulations. But it's a dangerous ploy as well, because he's not in control of what the police investigation is going to find. And if he does get fined, he's now been committed to resigning as leadership of the Labour Party.
The Labour Party had desperately wanted to take the moral high ground when it came to their handling of COVID rules and regulations, not just in the House of Commons, but in the court of public opinion. But now with their leader caught in the spotlight because of his own missteps, supporters of Boris Johnson are hoping to capitalise on this political mistake and make Labour pay. Whether or not the leader of the Labour Party is fined, for many of the electorate, this is yet another letdown. Politicians who seemingly are unwilling or unable to play by the rules. The police investigation could take as long as a month to conclude. Now Labour and its leader must play the waiting game and cross their political fingers that this high-stake gamble has paid off. Mina Taylor, London.
When you visit Afghan markets, especially those in Kabul, you find numerous Iranian goods. In some places, Iranian products even make a bigger part of bazaars, as their prices match the economy of Afghans.
Most of the goods we buy from superstores are products of Iran. They are of high quality and the companies have got a good reputation. Most importantly, Iranian goods are cheaper than those of other countries. I usually buy Iranian washing liquid, food items, and halal drinks. My family is happy with these products.
A number of salespersons and customers have also described some Iranian products as items with good quality. Cultural proximity is another reason for Afghans to dislike Iranian products.
First of all, Iran is our neighboring country. Its products arrive in Afghan markets sooner and cheaper. Second, their quality is also acceptable. For instance, this Danish cheese has an expiry date of 1 year, but that of Iranian cheese is 3 to 6 months. People usually like fresh food with short expiry dates.
I always do my shopping here at this nearby supermarket. Luckily, it has Iranian goods, which better match our demands and cultural values. We also share a common taste with Iranians. Let's not forget that Iran products are economically suitable for our situation. With less money, we can buy more items.
Iran and Afghanistan, besides sharing borders, have had many cultural and ideological values in common. The two countries are missing no chance to enhance bilateral trade ties either. There is no market in Afghanistan without Iranian goods. Nowadays, more and more Afghan families are turning to Iranian products, partly due to reasonable prices. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Conservative Yoon Suk-yeol was inaugurated president of South Korea in a ceremony in front of the country's National Assembly. Although President Yoon has vowed to take a hard line on North Korea, his address offered Pyongyang conditional assistance.
If North Korea genuinely embarks on a process to complete denuclearization, we are prepared to work with the international community to present an audacious plan that will vastly strengthen North Korea's economy and improve the quality of life for its people.
The South's President Yoon's words may ring hollow for North Korea, as President Yoon has promised to bolster the country's military deterrent and strengthen its alliance with the United States. Some analysts suggest that may be destabilizing.
The U.S.-South Korea alliance will improve considerably in the next 5 years of the Yoon Suk-yeol administration. But North Korea's nuclear capabilities will be enhanced and tensions on the Korean peninsula will heighten even more.
South Koreans want President Yoon to address a raft of domestic issues as well, including housing and economic disparity.
Stabilizing housing prices is a priority for me. And I would like to have economic policies that can make a better living for both corporations and individuals and cover blind spots in the current policies.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol wasted no time in demonstrating the hardline deterrent strategy his administration intends to take with North Korea. The U.S. and South Korean militaries began combined exercises with F-35 Joint Strike Fighter aircraft just hours before Yoon took office. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Victory Day is celebrated on May 9th in Russia as one of the most important holidays in the country, as it marks the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union. An estimated 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians were killed in the Second World War, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War, or the holiday with tears in the eyes. This year's celebrations come at a time when Russia's relations with the West are at their lowest level. NATO countries openly supply Ukraine with weapons and conduct military exercises along Russian borders. In his speech at the parade, Russian President Vladimir Putin talked about the ongoing attempts in the world to justify the crimes of the Nazis, recalled the actions of NATO in Ukraine, and explained the reasons for the military action in Donbass.
Страна НАТО не захотели нас услышать.
The NATO countries did not want to hear us, which means that in fact they had completely different plans, and we saw it. Openly, preparations were underway for another punitive operation in the Donbas, an invasion of our historical lands, including Crimea.
Putin has defended the offensive against Ukraine, describing it as a preemptive measure.
Кто разгромил нацизм?
We saw how the military infrastructure is being developed, how hundreds of foreign advisors began to work, regular deliveries of the most modern weapons from NATO countries were going on. The danger grew every day. Russia gave a preemptive rebuff to aggression. It was a forced, timely, and only correct decision, the decision of a sovereign, strong, and independent country.
And after the traditional military parade on Red Square, the president led the People's Parade. Starting 2015, the Immortal Regiment Parade is held in hundreds of Russian-inhabited localities from Kaliningrad to Vladivostok and in other countries. It became the most significant emotional event, as there is no family that has remained unaffected in Russia. All who remember and honor their own veterans of the Army and Navy, partisans, resistance fighters, home front combatants, Nazi concentration camp prisoners, come out with a picture of their beloved, those who fought or gave their lives for liberation of the USSR and Europe. In Russia, Victory Day remains the most important public holiday of the year. It is equally revered in many of the former Soviet republics. The Great Patriotic War, which started for the Soviets in 1941, united the entire nation and still remains a centerpiece of Russia's consciousness. Marina Kartunova, Moscow. The Palestinian conflict is the longest-running conflict on record for the United Nations. Multiple attempts at reaching a lasting peace have been and gone. Now, conveners of the Convivencia Initiative have spent years poring over a new document that they hope will become the blueprint for a movement that will push for a just peace for Palestinians.
People forget that for almost 2,000 years, Jews, Christians, and later Muslims lived in total harmony in Palestine. The Jews in Palestine were Palestinians. There was no division, there was no racism, there was no anti-Semitism. All these are European inventions.
The vision of stepping away from violence in Palestine and the region can only work if movements for peace are supported by genuine reconciliation and justice at their heart. Now, this bold new initiative being launched in London is putting true solidarity between Muslims, Christians, and Jews at its foundation and hoping for global success.
The suspicions around interfaith dialogue have also been an obstacle.
It was perhaps the first time I've seen something with a vision for Palestine, bringing together Jews, Muslims and Christians here in the UK and abroad, working together for justice and peace in Palestine. Because too often, interfaith dialogue is what I call lowest common denominator. I've been involved in activities with Jewish groups where they say, well, we can't talk about Palestine, or we can't talk about the settlements. And therefore, it shuts down genuine conversation about the causes of the justice in Palestine.
Obviously, without justice and equality and freedom for the Palestinians as well as the Jewish-Israeli inhabitants of that area, there can never be a proper peace. If there's not peace in the Middle East, we know that unfortunately there are ramifications for the rest of us in all our societies.
With a growing list of supporters, the hope is to spread the spirit of convivencia.
Even a little child understands justice. If we don't stand against injustice and support each other, what's the point of coming together? And this is really a challenge to create a better future for ourselves, for our children, not just in Palestine, but everywhere else.
For far too long, division has defined the ongoing crisis. But this new initiative is forging the path to a united and just solution for Palestine and the world. Amina Taylor, London.
Israel has sold its Pegasus software to dozens of countries around the world, which allows spies to easily hack into mobile phones and retrieve personal data. Apparently, very high-profile individuals have been targeted. Now, the PEGA committee inside the European Parliament has been set up to investigate.
We cannot overemphasize the severity of this scandal. When this kind of spyware is used against innocent citizens, whether they're journalists, activists, lawyers, businessmen or politicians, then regardless where in the European Union or even beyond.
The European Commission has been slated for refusing to take action against Tel Aviv for failing to rein in Israel's NSO company, which produces Pegasus.
This is about the accountability of the European Commission to the European citizens and to the European Parliament. You have a duty to investigate.
EU Commissioner Johannes Hahn told lawmakers it's a matter for national governments.
Mr. Commissioner, if you say it's member states in charge, would you mind telling me which member state is actually in charge of investigating in this and protecting us?
EU countries Poland and Hungary have been heavily criticised for buying the spyware from Israel. But one lawmaker says the bloc turned a blind eye when it was revealed in 2019 that Germany was spying on its allies.
Do not be a hypocrite. Do not point Poland and Hungary, point everyone, because who was in charge of German government? Madam Merkel. You were shaking in front of Merkel. Everyone was silent.
There was even a commissioner saying, oh, haha, I have a very boring life. There's nothing on my phone.
Experts say the it's fine, I have nothing to hide argument doesn't hold water.
At the heart of liberalism is saying exactly the contrary. You always need to hide and to have an umbrella against the eye of the state.
The European Parliament's PEGA committee is due to conclude its inquiry in 11 months from now. Already there is a great deal of scepticism that the EU will take any action against Israel regardless of the findings. After all, it has always shied away from doing so in the past. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Days after launching a massive manhunt across the occupied territories, Israeli military forces arrested the two Palestinian youths who carried out Thursday's deadly operation in the settlement of Elad that was established on the Palestinian village of Mzera, central Israel. 19-year-old Asad Arifai and 20-year-old Subhi Sbihat were arrested in a forest near Elad. Israeli military forces, Israel's intelligence agency, and Israeli police all took part in the manhunt.
The two heroes were arrested, but we affirm that they carried out a special operation, a move that has made Palestinians feel proud. The Israeli regime mobilized all human, logistical and technological capabilities to arrest the two youths. The Israeli military establishment will try to use their capture and publish the videos of their arrest to cover its security failure. But those two proved that the Israeli security is fragile.
Immediately following Thursday's operation that left three Israeli settlers dead and four others wounded, Israeli military took a number of decisions. First, family members of the two youths, who are from the village of Romani near Jenin in north-occupied West Bank, were arrested and interrogated, in addition to many others close to them. Experts now say the second step would be demolishing their homes as part of the collective punishment Israel imposes in such incidents. Israel urges the move is a deterrence act to force Palestinians to quit resistance.
A number of Israeli legislators and experts have promoted for killing senior Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in response to the current wave of operations, which he has encouraged. Meanwhile, the group's military wing issued a threat for an unprecedented response and a regional earthquake should Israel attempt to harm any of its top leadership, especially Yahya Sinwar. From day one, it was crystal clear for Palestinians that the two youths would be either arrested or killed by the Israeli forces. Palestinians say what the two have done was part of their legitimate resistance. They add the operation was a heroic move and in retaliation for the Israeli crimes and the settlers' incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump holds rally to endorse a celebrity doctor ahead of Republican Senate primary in Pennsylvania, which will have big consequences for this November's election. We have prepared for you an article written by Ed Pilkington. The piece is titled "Dr. Oz Embraced Trump's Big Lie. Will MAGA voters reward him in Senate race?" Whether Pennsylvanian conservatives go along with the endorsement when the primary race is held on 17th of May will have big consequences, not merely on Donald Trump's record of advancing his chosen people and with it his grip on the Republican Party. It will also have ramifications for this November's election, which, in tune with recent contest in the state, is almost certain to be nail-bitingly close and could be critical in determining whether the Republicans retake the U.S. Senate. The trouble is, many Trump supporters don't know what to make of Mehmet Oz, the celebrity television surgeon better known as Dr. Oz. The phenomena was vividly illustrated after the 6th of January insurrection at the U.S. Capitol last year. Republican leaders, including Kevin McCarthy, were at first critical of Donald Trump's role, but then began faithfully repeating his big lie that the election had been stolen from him. More recently, J.D. Vance, the venture capitalist author of Hillbilly Elegy, ditched his earlier criticism of Donald Trump in order to win the former president's endorsement in the race for a U.S. Senate seat in Ohio. The humiliating gambit paid off recently, with Vance sealing the Republican primary, having received a bounce from Donald Trump's backing. Of all the many examples of this form, there has rarely been as dramatic a shedding of fact-based reasoning in exchange for Donald Trump's universe of alternative facts than that displayed by Dr. Oz. He has descended from the scientific heights of a renowned cardiothoracic surgeon down through his promotion of quack remedies in his daytime television show and into a full MAGA embrace of the Trump big lie. Dr. Oz, a 61-year-old, has an impeccable medical background. Born in Cleveland, Ohio, he is the son of Turkish immigrants and followed his father into cardiothoracic surgery, with Ivy League training at Harvard University and the University of Pennsylvania. At his peak, he was an innovator in minimally invasive heart surgery. At Columbia University, when he treated patients until 2018, he authored numerous peer-reviewed papers bearing impenetrable sentences like this one. In the multivariate Cox proportional hazards regression analysis, CPB time, previous cardiac surgery, sternal wound infection, post-operative renal failure, and post-operative stroke were all associated with increased risk of mortality following MICS. His weakness, or strength, was the allure of fame and fortune. In 1996, he performed a heart transplant on the brother of the New York Yankees manager in the middle of a World Series, which the Yankees won. Such extraordinary serendipity turned him into a media darling. Oprah Winfrey came calling, dubbing him America's Doctor, and the end result was the Dr. Oz Show, which ran until this January. His show included public service broadcasting, bringing attention to type 2 diabetes and encouraging his viewers to eat more healthily. But over time, he slid into controversial territory. By 2014, he was being called a snake oil peddler and hauled before a U.S. Senate committee for touting miracle diet products on the Dr. Oz Show. During the pandemic, he championed several of the same discredited pseudoscience treatments, such as hydroxychloroquine, pushed by Donald Trump. To complete the decline, the cardiothoracic surgeon has now incorporated into his Pennsylvania Senate campaign the falsehood that the 2020 presidential election that Donald Trump lost was riddled with fraud. He said at a recent televised debate for the Republican primary, "I have discussed it with President Trump and we cannot move on. We have to be serious about what happened in 2020. There is no evidence that fraud on a significant scale occurred in the 2020 presidential election in Pennsylvania or anywhere else in the United States." The problem with being a daytime television host is that you leave a very long paper trail. Dr. Oz's rivals for the Republican nomination have been bombarding Pennsylvania voters with attack advertisements portraying him as a Hollywood liberal and a rhino, Republican in name only. Among the inconvenient truths that the adverts regurgitate is the time that Dr. Oz invited Michelle Obama onto his show, his reflections on systemic racism and how it leads to disparities in health outcomes, and his discussions on how to reduce deaths and injuries from guns. The attack advertisements have featured a 2019 interview in which he questioned Republican states that were introducing bills to ban abortion at 6 weeks, known as heartbeat pills. The downpour of negative political adverts carrying politically awkward clips from the Dr. Oz show has clearly had an impact on the race. Latest opinion polls show the Republican primary race is too close to call, with the television personality in a slim lead on 18% to the 16% of his main rival, the super wealthy former hedge fund chief executive officer David McCormick. By contrast, the Democratic field of candidates appears to be already settled with a clear front runner, Pennsylvania's Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman. He's a champion of labor unions, legalized marijuana, and combating inequalities in income, health, and housing. Sharon Nagle, a 60-year-old, a bartender from a small coal mining town, said she was troubled by Dr. Oz's dual U.S.-Turkish citizenship. The issue has also been seized upon by Dr. Oz's Republican rivals, who have called his Turkish ties a national security risk, forcing him to promise to renounce his Turkish citizenship should he win the Senate seat. Sharon Nagle also objects to Dr. Oz's Muslim identity. Political strategists at the rally worked extra hard to try and overcome the chilly response to the Dr. Oz endorsement. J.D. Vance was rolled out on stage with a clear hope that the victory he pulled out of the hat last week might somehow rub off on Dr. Oz. The crowd was assailed through the evening with 30-second videos attempting to debunk the portrayal of the candidate given in the attack advertisements. Here was Dr. Oz surrounded by children insisting life begins at conception. Here was Dr. Oz dressed in a shirt brandishing a double-barreled shotgun. How could this man be against the Second Amendment? When Dr. Oz finally addressed the crowd, he reassured them that he was one of them, a genuine MAGA man. He said, "The president endorsed me as an America First candidate. President Trump endorsed me because I am smart, I am tough, and I will never let you down." Then Donald Trump himself bigged up his chosen candidate. Paying lip service to his followers' misgivings, he said, "We endorse a lot of people, a little out of the box." He reminded the crowd how Dr. Oz had invited him onto his show in 2016, giving the then presidential hopeful a great bill of health through telling him to lose a few pounds. Trump claimed Dr. Oz has had an enormously successful career on television and now he's running to save our country from the radical lunatics.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudin was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Mu'allim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is the teacher, I'm Atta, the host of this program. We've been in the studio for today's discussion to discuss the life and works of another Shia dignitary, our two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about another outstanding Shiite dignitary who become a faqih, and he is mainly known by his magnum opus, or the best work written in the Arabic language, known as Al-Urwat al-Wusqa. He is no one but Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Tawatabai Yazdi, also known as Sahib Urve. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you this episode. Give us some information about the early life of Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Tawatabai Yazdi, or Sahib Urve.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Tabatabai Yazdi, born in 1247 according to lunar calendar, to a religious family in the province of Yazd, in one of the rural areas. So as we see in his title Tabatabai, we have to mention for our listeners, I think this is of their interest to know, when we call someone Tabatabai, traced back to Imam Hassan as well, and they are called Sadat-e Hassani as well.
Yes.
Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Yazdi, actually at the beginning, he didn't join the scholarly life. He was farming at the beginning. And then he goes for the seminary school and start his scholarly life. And he stays in Isfahan to some level, to actually complete some levels of his seminary studies. And then from them, he moves to Najaf. And after a while, he leads the Salat in Sahna Alavi.
That's right.
In Najaf al-Ashraf, because of the position that he can gain through a short time of his stay in Najaf. One of the very important aspects of his life that we have to consider in our discussion for today is his engagement with the politics, specifically the politics of Iran.
Yes.
So we know that it is said in the history that we had the split of two Kazim. One is Kazim Akhund Khorasani, yes, and the other is Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Tabatabai. And this split happened on the issue of the constitutional revolution. Movement. So this split between these two Qadim happened on the issue of Mashruta, according to the protocol, actually history of Iran, and also it is translated into constitutional revolution or movement in Iran. So Sayyid Kazim Tabatabai is one of which who stayed with the side of Sheikh Fazlullah Nuri. He disagreed with the Mashruta, while Akhund Khorasani, he stayed in favor of Mashruta. And by the end of the day, everybody realized that the side of Sayyid Kazim Tabatabai was the right side.
Okay.
The way,
of course, Mashruta was deviated from the Mashru'a.
Yes,
you know,
definitely.
Part.
Yes.
As Mirza Naini also, you know.
Sayyid Kazim Tabatabai, he was actually against to this Mashruta that was known to all people, and that revolution happened, and Sheikh Kazim, actually Akhund Khorasani, he defended from that thing, and after all, everybody realized the way Britain people or Britain government betrayed Iranian nation.
That's right. Yeah. But the case, it is documented that they had respect for each other. I mean,
yeah, definitely. We will talk about their agreement also.
Yes,
yeah, his political life, we have to talk. As I said, this dimension or aspect of his life must be actually considered in our discussion for today.
Yeah. And when the Italy colonized Libya, you know, one of the African countries, this was Sayyid Kazim Tabatabai who issued a fatwa against it, Sheikh Ziyaniya. I mean, politically was active too, isn't it?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We should notice that in respect with this argumentation, or we may say, as some people may call, dispute that took place between Akhund Khorasani and late Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Tabatabai Yazdi, some people were accusing Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Tabatabai Yazdi as a person that is the fan and is in favor of dictatorship. And he is not
following political issues, so that he is not smart in this regard and he is not the man of politics.
Yes.
But we see that he had some issues with Mashrute or with, this movement.
Yes.
That he was believing that Mashrute is getting people of Iran far from religion.
Yes.
And after some years, it was clear that his idea was correct.
Yes.
And we should notice that Akhund Khorasani rahmatullah alayhi also at the end of his life.
Yes.
Noticed that there are some problems in Mashrute, and that's why he decided to travel to Tehran to prevail the movement from having these problems. But unfortunately, his demise took place. But after the demise of Akhund Khorasani, we see that Sayyid Muhammad Kazem Tabatabai Yazdi is a politician.
Yes.
And in different occasions as the one that you mentioned, yes. The invasion of Italy to Libya, late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Kazem Tabatabai Yazdi gave a verdict, a fatwa,
yes.
To urge people to defend Libya against Italy.
That's right.
And says that this defense is wajib and is obligatory upon the shoulders of Muslims.
Also where the Britishers were also in Iraq.
Yeah.
When they were invited to Kufa, you know.
Yeah. Another That's important right. point is
yes.
that
yes.
when the British troops invaded the lands of Iraq.
Yes.
Again, Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Kazem Tabatabai Yazdi is the one who is
yes.
defending the rights of people and says that standing against the colonizers is wajib upon the shoulders of Muslimin.
Right.
So we see that he was a politician, but his point of view was in some events and in
yes.
some degrees was different with the views of late Ayatollah Sheikh Muhammad Kazem Khorasani, or as it is famous, Akhund Khorasani.
That's all right. Some of the students and pupils might had disagreements, even conflicts between each other, but it was recommended from both sides, I mean, both Sheikh Muhammad Kazem al-Khorasani and Sayyid Muhammad Kazem al-Yazdi, to we can say, observe respect toward the Marja'iyah and in such conflicts. And we know that on that time, Iraq and Iran were the centers of the conflicts between the national groups, Islamic national groups, and the foreign colonial powers. In all these, we can say, atmosphere, he compiles a book which is still remembered, and so many commentaries and explanations are written on that. And that book is Al-Urwat al-Wusqa, up to an extent that Sayyid Muhammad Kazem Yazdi, Tabatabai Yazdi, is known by we can say Urwat al-Wusqa, Sahib al-Urwa. Let's talk a little bit about this book too. What is this book exactly, and what is his method of research in this book?
Okay, as you said, this book is that important that Sayyid Kazem Tabatabai, he is also known as Sahib al-Urwa. Why right. is it?
Yes.
In order to know more about it, let us just know how this book has earned the respect of the great and outstanding maraji, not only the students of the Hawza or the scholars. Among the great maraji, actually, in some certain, actually to some certain levels, you might say, for a marja to reach this level or to actually show that he has mastered fiqh usul, it was one of the criterion to write a commentary on Al-Urwat al-Wuthqa. So among the names who wrote commentary on Al-Urwat al-Wuthqa, we see the name of Mirza Hussain Naini, Sheikh Abdul Karim Hairi, the founder of Hawza Elmiye Qom.
Yes.
And then among which we see Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, in one of our episodes, we talked
yes.
about this figure, and we see the name of Sayyid Hussain Burujerdi. Who is this Sayyid Hussain Burujerdi? He is the Marja'i A'la of
That's
Shia
right.
of Iran before the revolution. And we see Imam Khomeini as well. We see Sayyid Abul Qasim Khoi. All of these great and outstanding maraji, they have commentary on Al-Urwat al-Wusqa.
Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen al-Hakim, Mustamsak al-Urwat al-Wusqa.
Yes, that is another thing, because
yes.
it's not only commentary.
Yes.
He was trying to put or find out all evidences which
yes.
are supporting the fatwa of Sahib al-Urwa.
Yes.
For example, he would pick, let's say, the issue 1254.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, It says something regarding the classification of the water.
Yes.
Purifying water.
Yes.
So regarding that issue, Sayyid Mohsen Hakim has brought up all argumentations relying on the ahadith.
That's right.
So it is considered as a kind of encyclopedic,
yes,
voluminous book.
Yes.
I mean the work of Ayatollah Hakim.
But you want to say it reached a status, we can say a position, that so many of the coming generation and following generation after, yeah, Sayyid Muhammad Kazem Tabatabai wrote commentary on Urwatul Wusqa.
Yeah, because okay, we also can add top of what I said so far, that this book was enjoying a very comprehensive look upon the fiqh,
mm-hmm,
and very detailed issue, which all talked. Actually, which
is it? Is it more than Jawahir al-Kalam or something?
The approach of Jawahir al-Kalam is different. The approach of Jawahir al-Kalam is the ijtihadi approach.
Okay.
So over there, actually, lay people or ordinary people, those who do not have common understanding from the Hawza, they cannot benefit from Jawahir al-Kalam. But from this, the only thing you are in need of to know
is the Arabic language.
Yes, Arabic language. Okay. Because this is exactly the same as Tawdih al-Masail, but it was really comprehensive. And it was addressing Masail al-Mustahdasa, which was actually a unique approach at his time to address the Masail al-Mustahdasa. We mean all those new issues. That are not common.
Yes.
So it is regarded that...
Or are new to the generation or to the years that he was living.
Yes, so it is regarded that Urwatul Wusqa is one of those books which addressed for the first time the Masail al-Mustahdasa in that level. I mean, very vast...
Broad level.
Yes, broad level. Yeah,
that's right. All right. Thank you very much. Our final moments of the program, Sheikh Ziyaniya, do you have any other information about the fruitful life of Sayyid Muhammad Kazem Tabatabai Yazdi?
Something that we should consider it carefully is that our scholars and Maraja were the people who were defending the rights of Muslims in different angles and in different dimensions.
That's right.
For example, something that is very important in Islamic economy is that Muslims should consume the products that are produced in their own countries.
Their own Muslim lands, you mean?
Yeah, okay. I mean in their own Muslim lands.
Very good.
And when the British troops were invading Muslim lands, one of the shuyukh in Iran started to urge this movement that Muslim ummah consume the products of Muslim ummah.
Okay.
And he introduced this letter to different scholars, amongst which most important figures are late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Kazem Tabatabai Yazdi and late Sheikh Muhammad Kazem Khorasani or Akhund Khorasani.
So these two great figures,
yes, they have this common point in this field that all Muslim nation should have this emphasis on consuming Muslim products.
That's right.
In order to protect themselves against colonialism.
Thank you very much. Shirkat al-Islamiyya. It was Shirkat al-Islamiyyya. And in a treatise called Libas al-Taqwa, he invited the Iranians and the Muslims in order to consume the products which are produced, something which is needed very much today, I think.
Yeah.
We can say in today's world and for the Muslim lands in order to have their own economy, economic independence, you know, and their own products on the Muslim lands which are produced inside the Muslim lands. Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya, for a nice elaboration regarding the life of Sayyid Muhammad Kazem Tabatabai Yazdi. Rajab 28, 1337, according to the lunar calendar, is the day that he passed away, and his body was taken into a mosque called as Umran ibn Shaheen around the holy shrine or inside the holy shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam. May Allah bless the soul of Sayyid Muhammad Kazem Tabatabai Yazdi, mainly known as Sahib Urve, or the author of Urwatul Wusqa, one of the most outstanding fiqhi books of the Islamic houses. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode and introducing another Shiite dignitary and a scholar, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. God bless you all and fi amanallah. Our voice comes.
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.